I'm not like them, but I can pretend. I think I'm dumb, maybe just happy. I think I'm dumb.
Welcome back, Thoughts and Prayers, fam. Hi, A.
What's up?
Everyone was seemed really enthusiastic about you being more of lead mic last time, so I'm gonna try not to dominate with my intense homosexual presence this time.
You've got your fans too, you know. It's if they get too much of me, they'll get sick of me. So you know, you gotta dole it out.
Yeah, but I haven't listened back to Pool House's A Mind Space, and I'm sure it sounds like two corgis just like having a total like panic attack on over something.
No, it was good. Everyone should check that out if they haven't listened to it yet. Your Bret Easton Ellis Space.
Yeah, both of us actually are on Backlash in the last 2 weeks. So go back and listen to, the extended universe is getting confusing. low IQ moron A is on Bear Bactrian, and I am on Backlash this week. And speaking of, and subscribe to our Substack for your otherwise. But speaking of, we have another Backlash orbiting podcaster here who does a live show with Pool House. Welcome, also.
Hey, guys. Glad to be here. I did listen to the live space for a little bit when I had time, and it was really good. Do you like being in spaces, or do you feel weird having to like communicate inside those things?
I like being in spaces. That's how I started even pre this podcast. I would just go into like totally insane spaces and just talk to people. So I enjoy it, actually.
Hey, are you a space guy? Or are you strictly pod?
I like it, but I haven't got that into it. The only one I've actually done was the TQ debate. Which was a while ago at this point, with Amy versus Basil. So now that was fun, but yeah, I'm a big fan of your and Pool House's I Was There, which, yeah, everyone should check that out if they don't already. But yeah, it's this thing about spaces is like, because I usually can't just the way the timing or whatever, I'm usually not able to listen like when it's live. So I'm usually like after the fact, but it's fun. It's cool. You know, I like that you can bring up speakers like who are just like listening or whatever. It's cool.
So. Yeah. It's been fun to do. I think, Pool House and I have gotten to a point where we kind of like know the flow of it. It can be sometimes difficult to, I guess, wrangle people on there. Like that's the, yeah. That's the one difficult part about spaces is like, I've had to do my like Zoom boss mode where I like, okay, I'm muting everybody. Like, this is ridiculous, you know, but, overall it's fun. And like, I think it's kind of like a underutilized part of Twitter. Like, I think there's some people using it in some cool ways, but it's been fun. Like, you know, it's been going on for maybe like 6 months or more now. And we kind of got like a little crew of people that come back every other week, and it kind of has built like upon itself to where now it's this kind of self-sustaining thing, which has been really cool. But yeah, I'm glad to be here. I feel like this is like the one podcast in this cartel orbit I haven't been able to do. And I've been like really excited to come and do because you guys have like one of my favorite shows. So
I know. I feel like
I actually wanted to elevate you a little bit. I would call I Was There live radio more than I would even call it a space, because
thank you.
I have had some nights deep in some some various substance hazes where I've entered like it's like 10 neo-Nazis are like, you know, fighting over something, like, you know what I mean? And it's like the most insane, or it's like tranny hour, and it's just like what I was like, you guys are like are running an actual like live radio
it's experience. A classier affair. Yeah
it's not like it's not like a goon space or like a or like a space of people who are just like chaotically screaming at each other. It's like you have an a you have a like a you know it's a radio show as well.
We have themes.
I remember one of the themes of one of the episodes was like you called it Not Guilty Pleasures. And yeah. I thought it was gonna be about like times that you were found not guilty of crimes. So I actually had a great story for that one. So
wait, hold on. Now do you have like a Cliff's Notes version you can tell us? Were you arrested and charged with something? Or is this,
I was. No,
okay,
yeah,
well, you don't have to.
Maybe I'd be happy to share it maybe another time. But yeah, I was arrested for a DUI and it went to trial and I was found not guilty. So
hell yeah, dude.
yeah, and no, it's a great story, honestly.
He was actually not guilty.
Oh no, so, I was guilty.
I was trying to
Doesn't matter, Q, double jeopardy. I'm a free man, yeah.
Is the statute of limitations passed? Can we talk about this legally?
Yeah, well, no, because I was found not guilty as trial. There's nothing they can do. They can't prosecute.
Yeah,
I could have walked out of that room and said, fuck you, judge, I'm guilty or whatever. There's nothing they could do, you know?
Right, that's true. Yeah.
Well, I'll follow up offline maybe at some point.
Yeah. So yeah, but you know, we've been trying to get you on here for a while now, and it just for various reasons hasn't worked out up until now, but very glad that you are here, Oso.
Yeah, I wanted Oso to come on because I'm obsessed with his movie recommendations, and he's the first time we tried to have you on, which I think was just truly because there was like chaotic scheduling stuff, but you're the only other person I've ever heard talk about The Empty Man, which we're not talking about today.
No,
but that's a movie that I'm like kind of obsessed with, and I was like, whoa, he's watching like weird movies that I like that are like kind of critically panned, but mm-hmm. like he has interesting things to say about them. So I love your lists, and one of the movies, I guess we should go ahead and introduce it, is that is The Black Coat's Daughter. Which is what we're talking about today. And I guess I'm curious before we even talk about it, because you truly, I feel like I know like 8 Twitter people who have mentioned watching it because of you. And it wasn't, even though it has some pretty like big-ish actresses in it, I had never heard of it until I saw it on your Twitter page.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering like how you discovered it and yeah, what made you kind of put it out into Twitter in a way that sort of got people interested in it.
Sure. So Black Coat's Daughter came out, I want to say, in like 2017. I think the way that I found it was how most people found it, which was it got chucked up on streaming. So it was on Netflix originally when I found it. And I think based on, I just checked it out because of the description, but also it had Emma Roberts in it, and I'm like an unabashed Emma Roberts fan. And so I was going to check it out, even if it was like shitty or not, and found it to be like really, really compelling in a way that I hadn't found a lot of like horror movies. Even in like kind of the, as you're getting into 2017 and we're kind of moving into like the era of like prestige horror films, you know, like the kind of like A24 era, which I guess technically maybe starts with like Hereditary and continue, you know, is kind of continuing on, you know, to this point. And, you know, this,
I'm looking at it now. It was actually a festival film.
Yeah.
A24 acquired the distribution rights to. So that's weird to begin with.
And it originally had a different title too. I think it was called February, which I think is just a terrible name for a movie. And I think it actually came out on streaming in Europe as February before it got retitled and picked up by A24. The other thing that kind of grabbed me was the writer and director, Oz Perkins, who's the son of Anthony Perkins from Psycho. So this was his very first feature, like it was his very first time directing a movie, which kind of blew my mind even more because of how, you know, artfully done the movie was, which it's like this guy came out fully formed as a director on his very first attempt, which I thought was like pretty fascinating. So yeah, it just became this little movie that was on streaming, and I kind of would tell anybody that would listen to check it out. And I don't think I even recall anybody disliking it once I kind of had given that out as a recommendation. So I know you guys were into it too. Was it the first time you saw it when I maybe mentioned it on Twitter?
For me, definitely. And I know A just watched it just for this episode.
Yeah, my wife is a big horror buff. And so she had actually seen it before. But yeah, she watched it again with me for this. So yeah, we can talk about that too. But no, this was the first time I had seen it. And I saw, I like to, with all this stuff, like poke around at the director and stuff and see what, and it was super interesting, actually. Like he, like you said, he's the son of the actor who played Norman Bates in Psycho. But then he's also just seems like sort of weirdly, the weird sort of occult synchronicities in his life, such as, his dad, the Norman Bates guy, actually died of AIDS. And his mom died in 9/11. Like she was a passenger on one of the planes on 9/11, which I thought was interesting.
So he also has like a shot for like a hot, like I guess he has a shockingly like low internet profile, sort of, for someone who's kind of you know, in the Hollywood world. I know that we're not freaking you out, Oso, because Pool House is like way into this shit. But yeah, I mean, there's some weird.
I just thought that was crazy. Like your parents both die as part of these like prominent like psyops of the, I don't know, just weird, you know.
Yeah, not to mention just like the that you're. Dad is famous for this like famous occult movie,
and then
you make this movie with, you know, two of the three actresses went on from this movie to become like really, really famous. You know, so I guess Karen Shipka was already in Mad Men, and Emma Roberts had already been in American Horror Story. But it's even weird that like I had never heard of this movie. It's so weird. I'm a huge horror until you mentioned it. Also, like I'm a huge horror movie. Buff. I love watching horror movies, and I love Catholic schoolgirl imagery. I'm gay, so in a non-perverted way.
Sure.
And you know, I had just never heard of this movie till you mentioned it. I just looked; it like barely had a box office release. You know, so
yeah. And actually, his second movie was, which is called "I'm the Pretty Young Thing That Lives in the House," which was also on Netflix, and also. Good. I did not like it as much as Black Coat's Daughter, but also a very, very slow burn, atmospheric haunted house movie. I think they were like, they had picked that up and that was getting ready to air or distribute before Black Coat's Daughter got picked up. And then they actually ended up switching the release date. So like his second movie was supposed to come out first and then Black Coat's Daughter kind of took that release time. But yeah, the setting, you know, taking place at a, first of all, you're right, Catholic school, there's always going to be kind of this inherent atmosphere over it, especially when it's like a story about satanic related things or demonic things. The other thing that really struck me initially when watching this was how cold the movie feels. And I mean that like in an actual physical way. Like this movie takes place over a winter break and almost every shot in the movie does have this very cold feeling to it. And I remember the first time watching it, having to like put on a hoodie because I actually felt like physically cold from watching this movie. And I think the only other time that's happened was when I saw The Revenant. Like it was just, there was so much pervasive cold atmosphere in the movie that it kind of went over to the physical. And like that was a big thing. But also the not abandoned, but like the emptiness of the set and the emptiness of the plot. So it takes place over a winter break at a Catholic school where everyone is gone. Right. So there's kind of this odd, and I hate the way this phrase has been co-opted lately, but this odd kind of liminal in between phase that the school is in during the plot of this movie, the kind of empty nature of it just really, really ratchets up the atmosphere of it. So just, you know, obviously the plot, and we'll get into that, because it is a very unsettling plot, but just the way that Perkins kind of sets it up with not only the setting of the place, but at the time and place of it, just really gives it this feeling, you know, pretty much from the first scene, a very isolated, cold feeling.
Yeah. Incredibly spooky vibe. Just like you said, like the empty, dark halls of the school and stuff. Yeah, it's unsettling.
Yeah, I mean, even in the school, it seems freezing. The girls seem cold. They're all incredibly thin. I thought about that. They're like very, very kind of emaciated. I have no idea if they asked them to lose weight for the roles or not, or if that's just how they look. But, you know, they're tiny. They never seem to have enough layers on. And I was thinking about in the, especially for like a Massachusetts winter. And then I was also thinking about, the liminal space thing you just said, like in the, we'll start getting into the plot, but like in the, there's kind of two timelines, and in the present day timeline, it's also very liminal spaces, right? It's like a bus station, and then it's like a roadside motel, and it's like a, so there, you know, the whole movie sort of exists in this, like, yeah, like this in between space. A lot of the present day scenes take place in a car that's moving, so they're not really anywhere. you know, sort of.
It's like limbo. Yeah, you kind of feel like you're in limbo during large chunks of the movie.
Mm-hmm. So I guess plot wise, we should break it down a little bit. There's three sections, which I think is always good for a movie to do, to be honest.
We should probably say spoilers, right? I mean, I know this is a 7 or 8 year old movie, but there is some twists in this movie. So we'll definitely be talking about those.
Yeah, we're going to spoil everything. So don't even, there's no reason to listen. If you really want to watch it, stop. Absolutely.
Stop it now. Yeah.
And like the twist is good, but I would say, I mean, to me, it's still well worth watching, even if you know what's going to happen. I mean, I kind of basically predicted what it was going to happen, you know, or what the deal was.
Discerning viewers can pick up the twist without too much trouble, but it is still still a little shock the first time you see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the three parts are, I think it starts with Rose's part, right? So Rose is she's like kind of a junior or senior kind of like seemingly popular-ish girl at this school. She thinks she's pregnant. Her period's late.
And an interesting thing, by the way, I don't think she ever actually says the phrase, "I'm pregnant," which is kind of interesting. Even in the conversations with the guy who we assume is the one that kind of knocked her up, They play around the outskirts of the conversation, which I thought was an interesting choice.
Yeah, she says things like, "I'll take care of it. It's my problem too." But she doesn't really say specifically what's happening. So she's sort of like, telling her friend, smoking a cigarette out the window. She goes to the nurse's office. She acts like, you can tell she's kind of faking everything she's doing, because she's basically has a plan to make her parents come a day later than they're supposed to, so that she can go see this boy. Which it cracked me up, because when I saw the boy, I was like, he's kind of exactly what I imagined. before it even got to him, I was like, this is exactly like the type of guy.
Was he kind of like a goth punk guy?
Yeah. Like, just, I was like, this is totally a dude who would like knock up a Catholic, like probably he's like 3 or 4 years older than her, you know? In the same early Rose scene, we see Karen Shipka's character. What's her name in it?
Cat.
We see her getting told by the she's acting weird the whole time. She's getting told by the priest that he's not going to be able to see her performance. She does sort of a Joanna Newsom-y performance. And her parents also don't show up, but we get the distinct impression that something sinister has happened with Cat, or Cat's parents.
She's having a dream. We see a dream sequence where she walks up to a crashed car. And so we kind of get the impression that something's coming, or she gets a feeling or has some kind of impression that, yeah, her parents are dead or are going to be dead.
Yeah. So they're stuck at this school. And that's basically I would say that and the Rose leaving, meeting up with the boy, are pretty much the entirety. Oh, and I guess we have to mention the one thing. Rose turns to her and says, there's two sisters who work at the school. We're not really sure if they're supposed to be nuns or not. They're not in habits, but they could be nuns. I went to Catholic school with nuns that didn't wear habits. They don't always wear them. Anyway, but she refers to them as the two sisters. And these are the women sort of tasked with taking care of them while they figure out where their parents are. You get the impression they're sort of like nurse / den mothers or whatever sort of role at the school. And she says that she tells Kat in a really scary way, kind of to scare Kat, that they worship the devil, and that they don't have any hair on their body. Yeah, and they wear wigs. And she does that to kind of be mean, because she's about to leave to go out with this boy, and she kind of, it seems
she's
like she's
annoyed that she has to play babysitter for this freshman or whatever who's like left behind at the school.
Yeah, Rose is kind of like the, like you said, she's the popular but kind of like mean older mean girl archetype, you know. Mm-hmm. Doesn't want to be caught having to babysit for this freshman, but does plant the seeds for the plot, right? Talks about, you know, the satanic sisters that are on campus. And you can tell that obviously freaks out Kat at the time, because we kind of get her point of view for the next little bit of the movie, after Joan goes to see the punk rock boyfriend.
No, Rose.
Rose, yes.
Joan's the next one.
Joan pops up later, my bad.
Should we just plow quickly through the plot and then just talk about impressions? Is that maybe the easiest way to do it? Okay, so section two is Joan. She's, it seems like, a young woman in her 20s. She's in a basically a bus stop in Massachusetts. I've ridden on buses up there. They all look like that. She doesn't have any clothes. She has no belongings. Spoiler alert, I guess we should just go ahead and do it. Should we do it now? Just because, you know, at this point, we're just talking about the movie.
No, I think you should do it. Do it later.
So Joan is approached by this man, and this man is like, do you need help? And she's kind of like, you know, acquiesces in sort of a very quiet way to this man's help. She gets in the back of the car. She says she's going to Portsmouth. This whole time, I was wondering if this dude was like a total pervert, is like sort of what I was like curious about. Mm-hmm. He takes her to a roadside hotel. And then there's this really, really tense, weird scene that's actually like not erotic at all, but where Joan is sitting in a towel after having taken a shower, and the man comes in and talks to her, and they have a very eerie conversation about whether or not Joan believes in God.
When I first watched the movie, that was like a very unsettling scene, because you're right. They didn't necessarily paint this, the character of this guy, as like a good Samaritan, right? And even if he was, you kind of get the feeling that like there's something underneath it, right? There's kind of this like undercurrent of unease when this guy is around. And yeah, to come into the hotel room while she's just sitting there in a towel and, you know, sit very close to her and have these type of like intimate conversation, I thought that's where it was going, that, mm-hmm. you know, this guy was up to no good.
Yeah,
because they don't really explain what his motivations are at this point for picking up this girl off the side of the road and like putting her up in a hotel. It's just kind of weird. Yeah, and he doesn't even really acknowledge that she's like in a towel or be like, oh, I can come back later or whatever. He just kind of like makes himself at home and like, yeah.
I mean, yeah, even as a gay man, I would never enter a woman who I did not know's room if she was wrapped in a towel and just sit casually and talk with her. Like, it would never, that would be a totally weird thing to do. So, by the way,
Joan, and you see this, I don't know if you see it at the bus stop or at the hotel, is ripping a bracelet off her wrist that shows that she was in a mental institution prior to coming to the bus stop.
Oh yeah, that's a big detail.
And she has a scar on her shoulder, which you see in the shower. She looks at the scar in the shower on her shoulder. And you see a very, very, very quick flash. I guess you do kind of realize at this moment that she's kind of sinister. This is kind of one of those things I love about this movie. It's like, who's the predator and who's the prey? And when she rips off the bracelet, you get a short flashback to her basically strangling this other girl and taking her ID. And it does a pretty fast flip where you think that Joan is in danger of some sort of, like, you know, sexual transgression, or this couple's going to do something to her. And then you quickly realize, like, oh fuck, like the couple's kind of fucked. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and I love those moments in movies when you think one thing's about to happen and then there's,
and
like
you
this...
see, there, I think there's also a flashback of her getting shot as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's clearly, now you know that, and she laughs. So you suddenly realize that, like, this couple is actually more likely in danger from her than she is from them. And yeah, I think, is that the end of her segment? I think
before it intersperses, it comes back. The timelines kind of weave in and out at that point, but we do go back to the school after that, Kat and Rose.
Yeah, and so, I you see there's some stuff with I'm kind of confused on the exact chronology of how it happens in the movie, but there's the part where Rose is wandering the halls of the school and sees someone, like, in the boiler room, like, kind of bowing.
Oh no, she sees Kat. Yeah, yeah. That's
oh,
true.
She's, okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I forgot that. Like, I think that from what I actually just rewatched it. I was literally in bed watching it when I was when I got on here. But she sees Kat when she gets back from the date. She's looking for Kat because she is a little bit like, even though she doesn't want to watch this girl, she's a little bit like, if something happens to this girl, I'm going to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. So she wants to, like, just kind of make sure she's whatever in bed or, you know, and she sees Kat in front of the boiler, bowing to the boiler and doing all this weird stuff. That does happen.
And it looks like, sort of, like super physiologic, like bowing very quickly and deeply in a sort of contortionistic way.
It was very unnatural. It was like she was like throwing her body forward in a very unnatural way in front of the boiler, which is a brief callback, because I think earlier when Rose is talking about the sisters worshiping Satan, I think she mentions that they were doing it down in the basement. So you kind of get this feeling that, you know, whatever she had told Kat earlier before she left for the date, has maybe stuck with Kat, and maybe that's, you know, one of the reasons that she finds her down there, very unnaturally worshiping a boiler, because that's what it looks like. It's like she is worshiping the boiler.
Yeah. So then basically the two girls have to go over to the sisters' like house that's on the grounds of the school. There's one dinner scene and then there's a second one. So I guess we can just skip to the second one, because the first dinner scene, nothing really in particular happens. It's exactly what you imagine. They're eating like thin soup. you
and
know,
Kat's acting very, very weird. You know, she looks pale. Yeah.
Yeah, she looks bad. She looks rough. So in the second dinner scene, she throws up into her. Oh, she can't say the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah, they ask her to say grace before the meal, and she like start just like is completely silent, and then like vomits on the all over the table.
Yeah, so she tries to start saying the prayer, but says the wrong words, which is like a very demonic film sort of. And they're kind of shocked because they're like, how do you not know that? Like, of course you know that. Anyway, so then she vomits on the table. And then they're trying to get, this is the only like maybe tiny bit of comic relief. They're trying to get her to take something. And she goes, get your hands off me, cunt. And it,
to the sisters, yeah.
it flashes to Rose's face. And she's like.
Well, and it's sort of in like a demonic voice.
Get your hands off me, cunt.
Yeah, it's kind of in the Dune Bene Gesserit voice.
Yeah.
So then they get a phone call, and they never really say it, but I think you're supposed to just obviously understand the phone call is that her parents are dead. Yeah. Because they then tell Rose, the priest is coming back. You need to go like shovel the sidewalk.
Go shovel the sidewalks.
Yeah.
Which I thought was pretty funny. They go down to the ground.
And she's like, what? She's the one who called you a cunt.
Yeah. So Rose shovels the sidewalk and then, you know, decides to go, tries to get back in the house, can't, and then just sort of says, fuck this, and goes and lays in her dorm and goes to sleep. And meanwhile, the only shot you get, you don't see what happened yet, but the only shot you get is the priest shows up, goes in the back door. And this is actually one of the scariest movie scenes I've ever seen, because you don't really see anything yet. You just see that there's some blood and he just looks terrified.
Yeah. So clearly something happened when the priest got there. It went into the house. But yeah, they do a great job of setting that up. And in fact, they probably could have like not shown it later on and it would have been just as effective. But yeah, that scene where the priest gets there was a tough hang the first time.
Yeah. So then I guess it's back. We're back to, which murders do we see first? I forget.
We go back to Joan. She's in the car with the couple, and the wife who is, not on board with picking up Joan in the first place and is very off-putting and cold towards her. They start to talk about a conversation that the man had with Joan when he took her to get something to eat, which was their daughter went to Bramford, which was the academy, and was killed. And so they were going back to, visit. Did they say visit the grave or just go back to visit?
I think that because remember when they get to the school, she really, really doesn't want to go there. So I kind of assumed they were going to like a graveyard in the town.
Yeah. But the mom kind of starts to go off on Joan and, you know, says, did he tell you that, you know, her head was cut off? And it starts to get into some pretty gruesome details in the car. And, you know, if by this point in the movie you haven't started to pick up on some of the intertwining storylines, this is really where it starts to kind of set off alarm bells of you know, what happens. But they do a pretty good job of distinguishing, or I guess not distinguishing, the timeline. So you think that these two things could be happening, you know, at the same time.
Right.
Because they aren't telling you that they aren't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... And I'm actually, even though it's interesting how muddled the timeline is in my head, but because it's like I've seen it so many times, but I think it's kind of deliberately like that. It's like a braid. But I guess
some little clues, I think, that like in the earlier timeline, no one really has cell phones.
Right.
And
yeah.
In the later one, they do. Yeah.
They do. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
But it's a subtle thing. Like if you weren't like paying attention, you wouldn't necessarily notice.
But they make a point of bringing it up. Like she says something like, my mom, they said maybe they'd get a cell phone for my birthday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Which like now every high schooler has a cell phone, but like was obviously still the time where that wasn't whatever. Anyway. Mm-hmm. So in what's happening at the school, which we've already said is in the past, you see that Joan, or you see that Kat has killed the sisters. You see him, her murder them, brutally decapitates their head, decapitates them, and then goes and finds Rose. Rose has a very small moment where she's in the bathroom and she looks down and realizes she had her period. She's so happy she's not pregnant. And then she walks out of the bathroom. Immediately, Kat attacks her, basically, and decapitates her, too.
That was a very anxiety-inducing scene for me, because you hear, like, she's in the bathroom stall and, like, figures out that she's not pregnant, but she hears the door kind of, like, creak open, and she's like, Kat? Like,
yeah,
Kat, is that you? Because she knows that there's no one else like at the school or whatever.
Yeah, it's an uncomfortable. So uncomfortable.
And when also, so when Kat attacks her, you know, she stabs her a bunch of times, but the decapitation stuff, even though we're not actually seeing heads being cut off, he does keep the shot on Kat while she's doing it. And the shot goes on for a while. Kind of did a similar thing with the sisters, which to me, like I said, is like just as unsettling as like trying to just show off, you know, like a gore scene, right? Like it would be real easy to put like a gory scene of like showing the actual head being cut off, but instead we hear the noise of it, right? And we see Kat as she's doing it, and it actually made it that part more effective to me, anyways.
Yeah, and you see the part that stuck with me is you see her hair in Kat's hand. So you can understand she's lifting up her head.
And she's collecting the heads.
And she's collecting the heads, right. So again, I'm a little weavy on the details, but I think the next thing you see is that and this is maybe when you really start to figure out the mystery, but the next thing you see is obviously the priest has discovered the nuns, and a cop bursts into the basement. Kat, I didn't even see this the first time I watched it. I had to, the second time I went back and I noticed this. She's sitting in front of the furnace with the three heads, lined up, and the cop comes in and says, the music is incredible in this scene. The music is so weird. And the cop comes in and he's like, put the knife down, and she starts screaming, "Hail Satan, Hail Satan, Hail Satan." And she won't drop the knife. So he shoots her in the shoulder. And Pool House actually made a joke when I posted that shot that it was Hillary Clinton's Vassar date.
I didn't notice the heads the first time I watched it. Just because the whole... At that point in the movie, because it has been up until that point kind of a slow burn, when the stuff starts to actually kick off towards the last third of the movie, the tension really is ratcheted up. So there were details like that that I missed just because I felt like I was like watching on the edge of my seat. But yeah, the heads are laid out in front of the furnace next to her, which is super fucking creepy.
Yeah, and then I want to get to reactions, so I'll try to move this part along quickly. But finally, we're in Kat's scene, so we kind of re-see everything through Kat's eyes, and we realize that she has a literal, or I mean, I guess the movie leaves it somewhat open, but she has a literal demonic presence that's talking to her, telling her to do things. You see the demon sort of as just a shadow off to the side.
Yeah, real peripherally. He's like always in the periphery of things.
Yeah, it's like when you're coming down off acid and you keep seeing things.
The shadow people.
Yeah, it's like that. And he like, and then you see like all the things that she's doing that were weird. Like when she laughs in the priest's face, you see the demon was, you know, there. And like, So pretty much everything we've said, you walk through that from Kat's perspective, but there's like a demon there.
Yeah.
And you don't like, you know, I don't know. I guess the movie sort of leaves it open, but the final scene with the demon is a priest. I don't think the movie leaves it that open. I think there is actually a demon in the world of this movie.
But, I agree, but that we can talk about that after.
Yeah, but then the final scene in from Kat's perspective before we flash back to what Joan's doing is that Kat is in bed. She's restrained, obviously in some sort of psychiatric ward. He performs an exorcism. The demon leaves, and she's
But she doesn't want that. She's like, no, don't leave.
Yeah, she's very upset.
She's very upset, like devastated to lose this being. And then flash forward, I guess I'll go ahead and do it now. Haven't figured it out. Joan is Kat. And Joan says she's sick, forces them to stop the car right in front of Bramford, which you can tell is now closed. It's all boarded up. Immediately she kills she got a knife from the restaurant. She kills them both, decapitates them both, brings their heads in a suitcase into the school, goes down to the furnace, but she can't. Whatever she wants to see, she doesn't see
it. She can't conjure the demon.
She can't conjure the demon. And the final moments of the film are her distraught in the snow, realizing like the demon really is like gone, or like she can't access him or whatever.
Yeah, just terrified and screaming at the very end. Yeah.
But what she wants, and this is what I think is so unsettling about the movie, is like she really wants the she wants the demon, and she's deeply sad that it's gone, that this is gone. And that was very scary to think about. So yeah. I want to hear what you and your wife thought, A, because you're the most recently to have watched it for the first time.
Yeah. So I mean, I liked it. I found it was very just disturbing and unsettling to watch, which I'll watch horror movies, but it's definitely not like my favorite genre. Like, I don't really like to be like scared and unsettled, and that's kind of the whole point of horror movies. So but my wife is a big fan.
Opposites of that.
Yeah. So she had seen it before and you know, was like, thought it was good, and so she was down to watch it again with me and stuff. But the biggest dispute that we had was like talking about it afterwards, was she thought it was intentionally ambiguous as to whether she was actually possessed by a demon or if it was like she was schizophrenic or something. Whereas I thought that it was supposed to be saying like conclusively that the demon was real, that she like was actually possessed.
What was your wife's argument for it being ambiguous? Or let's ask Oso. Oso, are you on ambiguity side, or are you on demon side? I already stated where I am.
So I'm ultimately on the demon side, but I do agree that he leaves enough in that you could definitely read it as ambiguous. Only because just some of the way the plot develops, right? So like early on, you see that Kat is having these dreams or visions or whatever it is, right, of her parents, you know, being killed in a car accident. So something's happening from the beginning where you can tell that she is not well mentally. Maybe she is, you know, kind of a lonely person, seems just a little bit off. The satanic stuff, and there's certain parts of the satanic angle, you know, you can read as Rose putting that into her head, right? Like, she wouldn't have known about the boiler. She wouldn't have known about the sisters being satanic. You know, that was put into her head, right? So, you know, you could read that way.
She does see the demon in the priest's office before Rose.
See, and that's
even have right. that conversation.
Yes. So and when we do get the flashback, we do see that, you know, that the demon, whatever it is hanging around previous to when she actually goes down to the boiler room for the first time. But I think some of the kind of like I don't know about you guys, but the one part that I kind of thought was a little bit cheesy, or I kind of laughed when it happened, was when Kat gets shot by the cop and she's screaming "Hail Satan" before it happens. Like, I thought that was like a little too on the nose, right? And that's why I thought like maybe that particular phrase was left in there to maybe keep some of the ambiguity in, right? Like, is she saying this type of stuff because she had it put in her head that there's satanic stuff happening, you know, in the basement? Because I don't think whatever is visiting her is like the devil himself, right? I don't think it's like Satan. I think it's like probably some kind of demon. But ultimately I do think it is a demon that's there, and the ultimate kind of I guess theme of loss is what really made it hit a little bit harder, and the fact that she was really upset that it was being sent away, and not only sent away, that it wasn't going to come back. And so I don't know, what did you guys think about like the boiler itself? Like, so obviously the boiler room is like kind of a creepy set piece, you know, for any type of movie. It's this like a, you know, weird, creepy room in the basement of a empty, you know, boarding school. But, you know, when she's down there worshiping the demon or whatever she's doing, we see the boiler on, right? Like we see the fire inside of the boiler. And then at the end we see the boiler again, and obviously it's not on, but she touches it. So I don't know. I felt like there was some sort of added significance to maybe like the boiler itself. And maybe that was like, representative of the demon. I don't know. I just thought it was interesting that the boiler kept coming up.
Yeah. I mean, I know, like, I mean, on the one level, obviously it's sort of a hell analog because it's, you know, whatever, subterranean, it's the fire element. It's like, but yeah, then I did notice that too, that like when she returns to the school at the end and tries to summon the demon, the boiler is off, it's not running anymore because the school is defunct. So yeah, I'm not sure exactly what that is supposed to like represent or whatever.
Well, maybe this is a point for your wife that the movie's leaving some deliberate ambiguity now that I think about it, because mm-hmm. if, you know, the boiler is like an actual physical thing, like, so, you know, by showing that, it's like they do leave this like tiny bit of like ambiguity, like, is she imagining all of this?
But it could be too, just like, like a representative of, there's no more like life force at the school to be like draining or whatever, like harvesting, and so the demon is just moved on or die, or you know what I mean, it's not,
yeah, I mean, that's what, yeah, that was like kind of the argument I made for like the pro demon, like the reason I assumed definitively that there was a demon is like, well, we just don't know like the rules or whatever of this, of what this demon operates in. So, you know, she could be down by the boiler because the demon likes being down in the heat. She could have been down in the boiler room because it's the only part of the school that's warm, and that's just where she wanted to be. You know what I mean? And the demon and the boiler really didn't have a whole lot to do with anything. So I don't know. There's lots of things. I mean, like, they're not going to spell it out for us because then it would be like a really bad movie. Like, this isn't this isn't like a, you know, like a Marvel Constantine sort of movie where they like constantly are telling us all the rules. But I also thought about how the Hail Satan thing didn't strike me as cringe. And it was because like whatever's happening to her, I had 2 points to make. First, just quickly, whatever's happening to her, she's going to apply her belief system that she's learned to it, right? Yeah. So she's going to decide, like, to use a word like Satan, I would say. A Catholic, someone who's raised Catholic, like, whatever's happening to her, she's going to apply her, like, you know, that's what she's going to put on it. Secondly, I think the reason I found it so unsettling is because regardless of whether it's mental illness or a demon, she loves it. And I've been thinking a lot about this, and I think a lot of people, I'm not the first to ever come up with this idea, but I think a lot of people, especially into today, are like addicted to their like mental illness. They're addicted to their anxiety. They're addicted to their depression. They do sort of love it in a way. They use it in this like identity defining way. And letting go of their mental illness can feel sort of like she feels when she lets go of, even though it's like this like destructive, bad thing in people's lives. Right. Like, and I'm using like kind of like, you know, I'm putting mental illness in quotes because I'm not trying to like project any beliefs about it onto other people. I'm just saying like, I think people are very addicted to their own demons and sort of obsessed with them, you know? And that's what the movie made me think about a little bit, like thematically.
Yeah, I would totally agree. Yeah, I mean, it's very reductive, but people think that it's expansive, right? Like they are very vocal about their mental illness, and they, like you said, they use it almost like a defining characteristic. And yeah, you can read the demon as mental illness, you know, and she was upset to lose that because that was like a defining characteristic of her. We don't really learn a whole lot about Kat previous to the events happening. You know, we know that she doesn't seem to have a lot of friends. Like we really don't see her interact with any of the other students. You know, the one student that we do see interact with, which is Rose, clearly does not want to be around her, doesn't want to be responsible for her. So all we really get is this sense of like loneliness from her. Right. We get this sense of loneliness. We get the sense that, you know, she knows that her parents are dead, or at least she believes in her head that they're possibly dead. So this is all that she has left at this point. And there's really no place for her. There's a line that I think the headmaster says towards the beginning of the movie, when we kind of get the news that her parents are going to be late or we're not sure where they are. He says something like, you know, we're on break. You can't just live here. You know, he says something like that in an offhanded way, but that line kind of spoke to me more, which is like, this girl really has no place. And I think,
well, and she's like upset that the principal of her school isn't going to see her recital. Like just caring that much about like, you know what I mean? Like clearly it's like, why would
she says something a few times? Like, I forget what his name was, like Mr. Gordon or something.
Yeah.
She was like, Mr. Gordon said I could stay with
him. I could live here.
Yeah.
There was another couple of things I wanted to touch on, which one of the more unsettling parts of the movie is that leading up to the stuff happening, Kat starts to get contacted by this thing. And one of the way that it does it is through a phone. So this is this boarding school where there's like not phones in the room, and there's a payphone like on the wall in one of these hallways. And the way that he sets up the shots with the phones are really great, because we get to see the whole hallway in the establishing shots. And it's just this very, like we said, it was very empty feeling. You know, the lights are off because they're just keeping the lights off in most of these other areas. So it's this very isolated liminal feeling. And she's expecting the phone to ring because it's possibly her parents, right? So she thinks that her parents might be dead, but she's also waiting on a call in the off chance that that was all in her head. You know, it's her parents calling to say, you know, sorry, honey, like we're on the way. And this demon thing is the one that ends up calling her. And I always find that like phone call related stuff in supernatural movies freaks me out. Like phone calls from the dead, you know, that type of like story really, really weirds me out always. And when this thing starts talking to her, it's fucked up. The scene's fucked up. And I believe it says kill the cunts over and over again on the phone. I had to turn on the subtitles because it's kind of like very low in the mix. But yeah, that scene really threw me for a loop when I first saw it.
Yeah. I think, okay, just to, in the camp of the demon is real, I offer as evidence that, so what gets rid of her demon or whatever in the movie isn't her stay at the psychiatric hospital. It's when the priest does the exorcism and gets, that's when it leaves. And then also that if it was mental illness, that would be, some kind of like severe psychosis or like schizophrenia or something like that. And I feel like, I mean, I guess you can have like situational psychosis, I suppose, like is a thing. But like if it was schizophrenia, there's no real like cure for that as far as I'm aware of. So like you can, if you take your pills or whatever, I guess you can kind of like lessen some of the symptoms. But I feel like then as soon as you stop taking it, then it comes back. So then like,
so you're saying the exorcism was not a placebo exorcism?
Yeah.
Well, because I would argue, but I mean, here's like what I would argue. It's like, and I guess I'm arguing this from like a person of religious belief. It's like, I don't know. How do we know that like schizophrenia like isn't demons?
Right.
Yeah.
know what I mean? Like, sure. we think we have this like medicalized way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, 200 years ago, they wouldn't have looked at it like that. They would have absolutely looked at it as like a demon. And it's like, we've decided like, and it's kind of like, it's interesting that you talk about the pills. Cause like, I've read a lot about schizophrenia and like the people who the pills don't really do much except for kind of just deaden you to the point where you're like not so much a harm to yourself or others because you're just sort of out of it. But I'm kind of like, I don't know, maybe schizophrenia is demons. Like that's sort of like, and it's more comfortable for us to believe like, okay, it's a medical condition. We have these pills that like maybe aren't the best, but they keep people alive. But I don't know.
Well, yeah, it goes back to like that, you know, science versus magic and like, where is the line between the two? And, you know, we think we know better now because, you know, we can look at things through a more secular angle, you know, but we've given things names and who's to say that it isn't the same thing. Another thing I thought of after the most recent time I watched it, which is, and this is in the pro demon category, if we're doing checking off boxes, the synchronicity of Joan, AKA Kat, breaking out of the mental institute at the same time that Rose's parents are coming the other way to go to Bramford. Like why then and there did she decide to break out? You know, she's clearly been there for some years, right?
I was going to give one point just quickly because I thought about this.
Okay.
I thought it was possible she broke out specifically on the anniversary of when whatever she did.
Okay.
So I thought it was possible that she was attempting to get to the school on the exact same day. And then I was like, of course, it's a major coincidence still. But then I was like, the parents going on the same day too to commemorate.
Interesting too that you said the original title of the movie was February. So yeah.
She probably did have the thought of the anniversary in her head, you know.
And so would the parents. So I was like, maybe, because I was trying to think, I was like, okay, if there's a demon involved, then them running into each other, totally believable, because now we're in the spiritual realm and like, you know, whatever, forces outside of them are acting to bring them back together. But then I was like, if we're in the total coincidence realm, I'm like, maybe it is possible that both of these groups of people would be interested in going to this space on the anniversary of when it first happened. And they, you know, yeah.
Now, do you think it's splitting hairs if I ask why the parents didn't recognize Joan, AKA Kat, as the person who killed their daughter?
No, I don't think it's splitting hairs. I mean, I think it's possible. It's somewhat possible they never...
Because they look different, right? And that's what people should understand. They're both blonde actresses, and there is a little bit of a similarity, but there's enough to where it's, you know, it throws you off until you start to pick up the plot points that they might be the same person, just aged a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think how many years is supposed to have gone by? Like 10, 12?
9 years.
Yeah. 9 years. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to imagine like someone I knew as a freshman in high school and I saw them at, I'm just now just going through it in my head. So I don't really have a clear answer for you, but someone I hadn't seen since they were a freshman in high school. And then I see them at 25.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm not 100% sure I would recognize them right off the bat, especially if it wasn't, and who knows, maybe there wasn't like, I mean, we have no idea what happened, but maybe there wasn't like a massive trial or anything. Like maybe her lawyers just did a plea deal and were like, she'll be institutionalized forever. And, you know.
So my other question is for you guys, where, and this isn't about a plot point, but I'm just curious, like, where would this rank for you guys? Like, would you think of this as like a satanic story? Like, is this in the same category as like The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby? Like, what do you think, like, genre-wise?
It's so funny you said this because I got in like a literal debate. So last night I go to this like movie club and we do it like once a month. And it's only a couple of us. It's like three of us. And we love horror movies. We always watch horror movies. And I said I was going to do this recording of The Black Coat's Daughter. And we were talking about how we should all go see the new Sydney Sweeney Immaculate movie together. And one of the girls goes, I'm excited for it because we haven't had a good Catholic horror movie since The Exorcism. And I said, what are you talking about? We all love The Black Coat's Daughter. We've all talked about The Black Coat's Daughter. We watched it at your recommendation in this little club that we have. And she was like, I don't consider it a she made this big argument. She's like, I don't consider it a Catholic horror film. And I was like, how could you not? I was like, there's an exorcism. There's a demon. Yeah. They're in a Catholic school. But she, her argument was, and I'll just give her argument, not saying whether I agree or not, is that Kat is not internally struggling with faith. And she thinks that there has to be an internal struggle with faith for there to be a, for it to be considered a religious horror film. That was her argument.
So since The Exorcist, she was saying?
I actually haven't, this is kind of crazy. I haven't ever watched the original.
I've never seen it either. I've seen Rosemary's Baby.
You got to watch The Exorcist.
I've seen Rosemary's Baby, where she is definitely having a, I would say she is having a struggle with faith. I would argue.
Yeah, she is.
I don't remember, but
she, in those dream sequences, that there's very much a repressed Catholicism upbringing that she's fighting with in those movies. I don't know if you guys saw the movie Saint Maud. That came out in 2019. I would consider that in a similar genre because I think she's Roman Catholic in that one. But
yeah,
I don't know.
She's struggling with faith too. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I really was like, I think it has all the hallmarks of like a satanic religious horror movie. But
I would consider it, I mean, satanic to me. I mean, it's literally Hail Satan. I mean,
and I liked the exorcism scene a lot because, mm-hmm. you know, and you, if you guys haven't seen The Exorcist, I guess it's pointless to compare it. But the exorcism scene in Black Coat's Daughter was like very understated, mm-hmm. and it was almost like very workmanlike. Like mm-hmm. the priest shows up, he takes out his little briefcase, and he goes through this in what seems like a decently short amount of time, right? Like maybe the span of
a couple minutes. It's almost like he's scared of getting caught. It's like he got a couple minutes with her.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want the nurse to walk back in. It's like you almost get the sense that like he's the only one that knows he's doing this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So he kind of surreptitiously is exercising her. But yeah, I was just curious because I was I sometimes don't know how to describe this movie to people when I am, you know, because they'll say, oh, you know, what type of movie is it? You know, obviously horror, but I never know what to say if it's like a exorcism movie or a possession movie. I feel like it doesn't neatly fit into some of these categories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really hard, I mean, like it's a really hard movie to like, I mean, it's definitely a horror movie. It definitely is scary. It is actually scary, I think.
It's got different element. I mean, cause it's almost got a little slasher stuff. It's got like the, a haunted house thing a little bit with the school, you know, it's got
psychological internal thriller sort of mm-hmm. stuff going on. That's why I liked it, I guess. I mean, just to like make a plug for it, if you've made it this far, I still think knowing everything about it, you could still watch it and enjoy it. But I mean, I think that it's like, you know, I personally think it's kind of stands in its own in a way. Like, I think Saint Maud that you brought up is maybe the closest film to this I could think of, but even Saint Maud is much more straightforward, you know.
Yeah.
Than this one is.
Have you guys seen any of Oz Perkins' other movies?
No.
So I'll quickly plug those two. Pretty Young Thing That Lives in the House, I believe it's on Netflix. Super super slow burn haunted house movie. Pretty decent. He also did his take on Hansel and Gretel, which came out a couple of years ago.
Oh, I saw Gretel and Hansel. Yeah. I remember laughing. I mean, whether I liked the movie, I did kind of like the movie. I just remember laughing and making some jokes like, oh, they had to woke it up. Gretel has to come first.
And I personally, I wasn't a huge fan of that movie. I thought it stylistically, it looked amazing. And I think they did some really unsettling stuff in that movie, but in general, I wasn't a fan. He does have a new one coming out that I'm like incredibly excited about, called Long Legs. And, it's going to star Nicolas Cage. And to me from the previews looks like a somehow more esoteric a cult version of Seven. Like it's a serial killer movie that the previews have made look unbelievable. So I think this guy, even if, you know, he doesn't execute every one of his movies great, he definitely swings for the fences stylistically, which I can definitely appreciate. But I will recommend this movie to anybody. You know, if you're a horror movie fan, or even if you're not a huge horror movie fan, I feel like it has the opportunity to cross over for some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't meaning to cut off the conversation either, by the way. I was just I was just making a plug for but anyway, I'm gonna watch this other one. Seven is such a creepy fucking film, but obviously very straightforward. It's not like a art house.
I know that you have done some stuff with Pool House, and I think on Basil's show you talked about this too, mm-hmm. just like the kind of history of esotericism, occultism in various kind of influential different things, but like rocket science and stuff like that. But I feel like, do you have any thoughts on the prevalence of like occultism and themes like that in media, which seem to me, at least, I don't know if it's just like I've become more schizo or if there's actually just like more of this stuff out, but it seems like lately, like everything is like about this type of stuff.
I have to ask myself that too all the time, like if I'm getting more schizo and just noticing it, if it was always there. I think to a certain extent, a lot of it gets put in, I don't think with any kind of like malicious intent, but maybe just because, and Pool House and I were talking about this, I think sometimes people just like the aesthetics of occult stuff. And so like they want to use, some of the terminology, or maybe they want to use some of like the aesthetics of it, but without, you know, really they themselves being, into occult stuff. Like I'm trying to think of a good example, but
what is that? Doesn't that in itself kind of mean something or suggest something, that their people are drawn to this imagery? And you know,
oh, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's definitely more prevalent, but I think also that people are more turned on to it in general. And I think sometimes,
like, don't you think people have always sort of been obsessed with the occult? Like literally, like I'm just thinking of like people on like the 15, like the witch burnings and like the crusades and like, I'm just thinking of all this historical shit. I'm like, haven't people like kind of always been like super fucking obsessed with like,
yeah, and maybe it's coming back around now, because like I said, we did become so secular for like the last 50, 60, 75 years that that sort of explained away a lot of like occult beliefs or interest in occult related stuff. And now maybe it's coming back around that people are finding interest.
I'm thinking of like even like a lot of, you know, A and I consider these like ops, because I'm really in like McGowan pill, but like there are like the Son of Sam and like all of that stuff. Like there was all those occult and the satanic mm-hmm. panic in the 80s. I don't know. I guess
the satanic panic stuff was like, I think sort of a cover up almost for some of these things being, you know, becoming more known to the public about like the Franklin
Franklin credit, right?
Yeah.
So like Basil and I talked about that, you know, and there was like legit satanic shit happening in the Franklin child abuse stuff, and like multiple victims, you know,
Presidio
went on record saying that it was happening
as well. Was like another
and they instance. Kind of I feel like they kind of didn't really talk about that angle of it as much, or at least we don't hear about it as much now. And I think some of the, if like I told somebody else about that reading like Program to Kill, because somebody was telling me about like the satanic panic was fake, and it was, you know, it was a ploy by psychiatrists to try to get their books sold. And it's like, no, there was legitimate satanic ritual abuse happening like all over the place.
And then they tried to, the media framed it subsequently as, oh, it's just this mass hysteria. People are just acting crazy for no reason.
Yeah. And when people get mad at me and say like, well, like, I don't believe in any of that stuff, I'm like, you don't have to for this to be true.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like for people to be doing satanic ritual abuse, you don't have to. You don't have to think it's real. Like they can still be doing it.
That's a great point. And like, that's what I say all the time. Like really when it relates to like magic and rituals and stuff like that. And it's like, it doesn't matter if I believe it's real or not. Like these people believe it's real. And
yeah, that's what I say. It doesn't even matter if it is real or not. If they believe it's real, it can still happen, you know, like.
And yeah, I mean, and we've talked about this too, where like it can have other functions even aside from the ostensible magical purpose, right? Where you can have it be this kind of in-group out-group distinction where you're amongst the powerful, where you know you can trust someone if you've both committed a horrible crime together in the same, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, yeah, it's like mutually assured destruction. Mm-hmm. Like if you know that there's, you know, and like this is something like, I mean, I know, oh, so you are so in deep in this too. So I'm not explaining anything to you. This is more for the listeners. But these ideas are not like stuff that like we're coming up with. Like they're really old ideas that the only way to ensure sort of like elite cooperation in things is for there to be sort of like something everyone does that's so taboo that they all kind of agree to like not out each other. So that's why people think it's stuff like, you know, pedophilia and things like that, because it's the most taboo thing people can, you know, imagine.
And it's good to have dirt. It's good to have dirt on people.
Yeah, like the same thing with the Epstein stuff, like the blackmail, sexual blackmail ring or whatever. But it was an interesting point that you made about like secularism. Because to me, that is also sort of an occult sort of initiative, right? Of like that the powers that be, so to speak, like there has been this move towards rationalism, scientism, and like viewing everything in this strictly secular materialist lens, which... even like space, right? Like all the emphasis on space and space exploration is like your life is meaningless and insignificant. You're one speck of dust in this one little tiny corner of the universe that nothing you do matters. And taking people basically away from God. And so even the secularism is kind of like all a part of that initiative.
Well, they've replaced, I mean, that's kind of why like I asked that question about like why couldn't schizophrenia just be demons, because they've just replaced these, like it's like everyone goes to a psychiatrist now or a therapist, right? And like, you know, it's just this like replacement for religion. Like people used to go talk to their clergy person or whatever. Like that's where they got that sort of like, you know, advice and that like what to do with certain hardships in life. And, you know, now it's like they've just medicalized it all, but I don't really think it's any different than religion. It's just like this new, like, yeah, it's like a new religion.
No, I think that like the sort of like, yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, laughing at people for believing in God and stuff like that is a way to demoralize people in a way, even if it's not overt, at least in a covert way, because I think it keeps people from being curious about expanding their own spirituality or asking questions about, you know, a connection to something bigger than them.
Like God is less crazy than the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah. And like, I can't explain science, like how it works. Like I don't know. Okay. Like if I flip on this light switch, I don't know the machinations, which in turn put the lights on over my head. But I have faith that when I flip it, it's going to turn on. Like, I don't see God. I don't know how God works, but I have faith that, like, when I'm talking to something, something's listening, you know? And I think to look at the two as one is enlightened and the other one is like backwards, is really, demoralizing. And I think that sort of, Redditor, you know, I fucking love science approach to life, which is kind of like the norm now, is such a bummer, you know? And, I just think that, like, for people to really expand their life and to find meaning, it really is, you have to allow yourself the space to ask those questions without just completely, shutting the door before you even start asking the questions. And I think that's what a lot of people do.
Totally agree. And like, I get it too. Like, for one, I mean, that's kind of the background that I came from. I was raised very secular. And so I do get that. And not only that, but there are legitimate problems with like institutionalized religion as well. It's not like it's just this pure good force that has been abandoned now. You know, like, there are reasons that people may have turned away from it and stuff.
But I think, this is a big defense that, like, I've had of, like, religion. It's like, you know, I think some of it has been coordinated at least a little bit. Like, I'm not saying there wasn't horrific sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, and that the Catholic Church as an institution, not as a religion, is evil in many, many ways. It obviously is. But also, I'm like, what are the sexual abuse numbers for like public schools? You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, it's like what the media chooses to.
Well, the other thing, and this is potentially opening up like a whole can of worms, but like, there's a whole thing about like the Catholic Church basically being infiltrated by occultists and Freemasons, like that.
Yeah, that could definitely be true. Yeah. I mean, like, I don't think like. Yeah, I mean, the church itself is not what I believe in. I think it's like you have to kind of believe in the religion.
But yeah, I think that having people turn away from any type of spirituality or like a belief in the divine is definitely detrimental. I mean, you can just see it. I mean, COVID is like a great example. Like, if you had a thriving culture and society that was like grounded in something, I don't know, more like universal or like that, it could not have happened like that.
Well, can you guys, and this isn't, I'm not like the Catholic Defense Force here or anything, but like, can you guys think of, I don't know, in the past 20 years, like in Hollywood movies or TV shows, like a genuinely positive example of religious faith.
Yes.
It wasn't
well,
like,
there's only one I can think of is the recent is Padre Pio, right?
Yeah. But it's usually
it was made by like canceled Catholic actors.
Maybe Passion of the Christ with
that. Maybe right. Christ, right? Again,
they caught a lot of shit for that, and it was like it was kind of the media.
He had to make it outside the system pretty much.
Uh-huh.
But it was a hugely successful movie, and like, you know, so
which shows you that it's not because there's no demand for it, right? It's because
but usually, you know, religious characters, especially Christians or Catholics, are an analog for some kind of backwards thinking or some kind of barrier to what the main character is trying to accomplish. So it's you know, or it's very specialized, you know, it's like Daily Wire, Daily Caller movies that are like specifically made for like a certain audience, right?
Or it's just corny. There's some out of touch, like
the God's Not Dead movies are like left behind.
Actually, not to get into this whole thing, but there are a lot of depictions I can think of like positive Jewish representation, like Jews being represented positively in media.
Oh, of course. Just saying. Yeah.
There's tons of Jewish religious stuff, like Sabbath meals and stuff on TV.
Holocaust porn and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. But even just like regular, I'm thinking of like tons of like TV shows, like where there's just regular old, like, it's like depictions of Jewish religious traditions that are like in a positive light, like not, you know. not considered negative or whatever.
Yeah, they're not the antagonists, which is what the Christians usually are in a lot of like mainstream Hollywood stuff.
Which is so weird. And like, it is weird when you think about the makeup of this country that that's the case. But it's because it's like, I do think there's a massive millions and billions, obviously there is, of people who are like religious conservative Christians, which I don't think anyone, no offense, Twitter people, but I don't think anyone on Twitter really is one of these people. I think these are people that exist like kind of outside of these spheres. And it's like, you know, you would think that even more than the Daily Wire, there would have been some sort of alternate system that would have like popped up to like cater to these interests. I mean, do you know how many fucking Mormons are out there in the West? Like, when you look at the numbers, it's crazy. It's like, why isn't there like a Mormon film studio? You know, like, I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe they're all just like wholesomely taking their 9 kids to the park or something. I don't, you know.
Have you guys ever done an episode on Mormonism?
No, well, I'd love to.
We had a Mormon
on
at one point. Yeah, actually, two sort of. Andrew James said he came from the Mormon church as well. But we didn't really.
We've had two Mormon or people who said they were Mormon at some point in their lives. But we've never done a deep dive on Mormonism.
Yeah,
obviously, I think it's really interesting. I think it's like funny that everyone thinks if there's going to be a civil war, it's going to be like along like conservative and like liberal lines, because I'm like, actually, like, if you look at the numbers out west, like the Mormons kind of probably could pull off.
Yeah, it'll be more tribal than that. Yeah. But the amount of like land and real estate that the Mormons own and money,
I'm like, they could like maybe pull it off out there. They could maybe and they're like very organized, and I'm like, they might. You know,
you guys heard of the Mormons that like settled in Mexico and basically had to like fight off like cartels and other stuff to establish this homestead in Mexico. Like, they're serious operators, you know, like it's a very deep faith.
It's the fastest growing world religion. I do know that.
Yeah. Well, Utah's a weird place, man. I like Utah. It's beautiful, but like, you know, that's where like those processed church people settled out to. Like, a bunch of Scientology people went out there originally. Like, it's just I don't know what it is about Utah. It just it attracts some very fervent believers in a lot of different things.
And that's what I think about.
So I just wanted to point out the name Scientology being the Hollywood religion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, and that's connected to all the occult stuff too, as you've discussed.
Oh yeah.
So with the, Jack Parsons and all that.
Yeah. I lived in LA for a couple of years, and, I lived like maybe 5 blocks away from, L. Ron Hubbard Boulevard. This entire chunks of LA are named after Scientology. And then my girlfriend at the time worked on the same block as the Celebrity Center. So I used to go down there and try to people watch to see if I could see celebrities like go in and out. And it's a very weird place, man. Very, very weird place.
They had one in, I don't know, I wonder if it's still there, probably. They had one right outside of the University of Texas campus in Austin, Scientology Center. Which I only went into one time.
Yeah.
They like offer you like some brochures, and they're like, if you're not just here to fuck around, like you can come, you can like come back and do a whatever. And of course I was there to fuck around. I was not there to like begin my Scientology conversion.
See, that's the thing. I'm afraid, like, what if I, as a goof, I start reading about it, and then like 3 or 4 chapters in, I all of a sudden I get it. You know, and then next thing you know, I'm wearing a white button-up shirt down in Florida somewhere.
Yeah, I feel too deeply invested in Christianity to ever. Like, I don't even consider Mormons Christian, personally. Sorry if that's controversial for people to hear, but
yeah, I won't argue with on that one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I think the distinction between like organized religion, which isn't all good or all bad, but I think it's important to recognize it is both, and having some kind of personal connection to faith, which I think is probably a good thing for most people.
That's what I always encourage, especially when people ask me, like, especially when like I get a lot of messages from I never know what word I'm supposed to use because of Basil and Pool House, but I get a lot of messages from homosexual or gay men.
Gay TM. I think they say gay TM now.
Or just even men primarily attracted to men or whatever word you, whatever phrase we need to use here. But they ask me, they're like,
habitual sodomite.
Like, yeah. They're like, how do you reconcile your faith with being gay? And I'm like, I just really, really, really focus on like my personal relationship with God, like my own prayer and my own prayer practice. And like, that's all that I think, like when you talk and you pray and you believe and feel that that someone is hearing you, like that's just what you should focus on and like not get muddled up in all this, like, you know,
the dogma.
Or get like too deep into like, I mean, like, I'm like, unless you're a theologian, like you really shouldn't be like, I'm kind of like against like lay people just being like, I can interpret all, you know what I mean? Like, you're not going to the divinity school. So just like focus on your personal relationship.
I'm sure divinity school is even like a scam in a lot of cases too. You know, I mean, it's like, it's just, yeah. Like, and even like the Bible, I get it's, you know, it's supposed to be like a divinely inspired book, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, maybe it's divinely inspired, but obviously it's had like human fingerprints on it. And so to, I don't know, like taking everything literally that it says in there, like, I don't think that really makes a lot of sense, you know?
The best thing to do, I just, as I keep saying, is just personal relationship. Mm-hmm. Your own prayer practice. That's what should matter. And I think the Bible and things like that are a guide. And, you know,
well, going back, do you guys think that that Black Coat's Daughter ultimately shows religion positively or negatively, or is it kind of indifferent towards it? And it's more of just a plot device.
I thought it was interesting that Kat, the older Kat, who calls herself Joan, said immediately she doesn't believe in God. Mm-hmm. I thought a lot about that and what that means. Because to me, if I was possessed by a demon, I would be like, I am certain God's real now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I have seen an otherworldly entity. Like, I have witnessed it.
But I guess... I mean, I'm not a theologian or a Satanist or any of that. So I guess I don't know how it all works, but clearly you don't, if you're a Satanist, you don't really like worship God, you know,
I actually don't know, because like they've done a really good job. And by they, I mean like the shadowy elites. Yes, I am one of those people, but like they've done a really good job of having that like forward facing Church of Satan. That's like so cringe and
yeah,
like
super cringy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, really dumb. It's like, they don't really believe in Satan. They just believe in free speech. And they've done an amazing job of like doing a forward facing, like super cringe lib Church of Satan. So I don't know what like true Satanists believe, because like that's very obscured by like so much, you know what I mean?
I think there's some belief in like, yeah, like some kind of supernatural entities, but it's specifically in antithesis to like even the whole like looking at the idea of like rationalism, like you're talking about like Satan, like modern day Satanists like love rationalism. That's part of the same thing. It's like part of trying to create a utopia on Earth, which is a sort of, it's an anti-God idea, because you can't have paradise on Earth. You know, it's like,
right. I'm just saying, I believe there are actually people who like do worship Satan, but I think they've done a really good job of like obscuring what exactly they like believe.
They did a good PR job. Like, it's the same way that like Scientology hides all the alien shit.
Right. So like, I've met like Satanist like TM. I'll use that. Yeah. So I've met like, you know, when I was younger, like in college, like meeting like punk people who were like into Satanism, but that was like, I know that that's not the real Satanists. Like, right. I know there's some like scary Rothschild, like something out there that like, I don't have any access to or any way of knowing what they believe. But I did think it was interesting that her character immediately answers. She doesn't believe in God. And maybe you're right. Maybe a true believer in Satan wouldn't believe in God.
And I doubt that most of these, same as you, obviously I have no idea. I've never knowingly met any of these people, but I suspect that they may not characterize their own occult beliefs as Satanism would be my guess.
Mm-hmm. Probably. I mean, who knows? Who and where the fuck is Kate?
I think it's more, esotericism, occultism, rather than like strictly.
Like, well, it's like Poolhouse always talks about the oldest religion, you know what I mean? Like, there's something that like predates all of this that they worship, in his opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like modern day Satanism is basically just libertarianism, with a humanist bent, you know, where it's less about worshiping Satan and more about anti-God, I guess, if that makes sense. You know, I don't even know if the Church of Satan does any type of worship stuff at this point, and it's more just performative. But the elites are the ones who are probably worshiping something, and if that's Satan, you know, or that's Moloch, or that's whoever, you know, I think that's the more devious branch of Satanism.
We should try to drive out to Bohemian Grove, when we're in California. I'm sure your wife would love that field trip. Yeah.
Tell her you're going to go look at redwoods or something.
Well, I think we've done a solid hour and a half. I think we could start wrapping it up. We plugged your stuff at the top also, but you know, for the three people who make it to the very end, go ahead and plug your stuff again.
Sure. Yeah. Me and Poolhouse do our show called I Was There every other Sunday on XFKA Twitter. Usually just do a couple hours every other Sunday. Usually there's a theme, and you're welcome to come. We love callers. And you can find me on Twitter at Oso Blanco. The last O is a zero.
And they do publish the live show on Backlash's RSS feed. So if you're subscribed to Backlash, which you should be, you'll hear I Was There in their feed. So
thanks for having me, guys. This was a blast. We'll have to do Empty Man next year.
Yeah.
Yes. And good. You have a full day, so good luck with your show tonight.
Thank you, guys.
Right.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks, Oso. Catch you later.
Oso.